If we want to understand the current state of the Chinese economy, we need to look further back in time, before the full brunt of the global financial crisis hit. Contrary to what is commonly thought, China's economic slowdown started earlier, in 2007, as part of an orchestrated policy of the central government. The tight credit policies introduced from Beijing were to prevent the economy from overheating, as Richard mentioned. Quarterly GDP growth in the middle of 2007 had reached 12.2%, and that was seen to be not sustainable. Like Western governments, the Chinese government did not foresee the extent to which the issues on Wall Street would get out of hand, impact upon Main Street, and from there the world. In China's case, the earlier planned managed slowdown was exacerbated by the severe fall in exports to China's major markets as the global recession took hold. From 11.9% in the December quarter of 2007, China's growth dropped for each of the next four quarters to 6.8% for the December quarter last year. And when measured on a quarter-by-quarter basis rather than a year-on-year basis, that growth rate was even more alarming, at an annualized rate reportedly between 0 and 2%. In other words, China's economy stood still. And it stood still for the first time in a long, long time. In the face of the global financial crisis, the Chinese government announced in November last year a 4 trillion yuan or $586 billion fiscal stimulus package, as Kevin mentioned. Such a package was badly needed. China's impressive economic growth over the last 30 years was built on the twin pillars of exports overseas and overseas flows of investment dollars into China, both of which fell away dramatically after October. Stimulus expenditure on infrastructure alone is expected to account for 43% of the package, which when added to the disaster reconstruction in the quake-affected Sichuan region, increases to 67%. And as Kevin mentioned, projects are lined up in railways, roads, airports, power, and irrigation, to name just a few. China has perhaps weathered the global financial storm much better than most, and there are now some tentative indications that China's stimulus policies are starting to take effect. China's first quarter GDP growth in 2009 was 6% on a quarter-on-quarter basis, and that compares to the 0 to 2% that I mentioned earlier for the final quarter last year. Industrial production, which is an indicator of China's important heavy machinery sector and one of its major sources of employment, was up to 8.3% in March compared to an average of 3.8% in each of the two previous months. And more importantly, fixed asset investment in China jumped by a massive 30% in the year to March 2009. And on the consumer front, the declining growth in retail sales finally plateaued. And one key factor behind these green bamboo shoots of hope that suggest a relatively more rapid recovery in China than in other parts of the world is the explosive growth in lending by Chinese banks. As Kevin mentioned, China's banks lent a record 1.9 trillion yuan in March itself. That was a six-fold increase over the previous year. Just as the Chinese government tightened credit in 2007, so this year it's loosened the credit taps. And in China's case, it can afford to do so, as its financial institutions are in a much better position than its Western and particular American counterparts. Not bogged down by toxic assets and sitting as they are on mountains of cash, China's banks have been asked by the central government to increase lending, both for investment and consumption. And of course, when the central government asks, the Chinese banks listen. In fact, only about 30% of the stimulus package will be funded by central government. The rest will come from bank lending. And a caveat on this, though, is the extent to which debt finance is actually drawn down, an extent to which it is actually invested. How much is being temporarily diverted, invested elsewhere, or simply just not invested at all is an important issue. We need to remember that Chinese investment figures are based on planned rather than actual figures. Now, with exports likely to remain anemic for some time, China needs to find a new, sustainable engine of growth. And the Chinese government is looking internally for that, to its own huge domestic market. But this may be more difficult to achieve than you may at first pass imagine. It's important to remember that many of China's population, and the baby boomers in particular, lived through the turbulent Cultural Revolution. And they've been conditioned to save and put money away for a rainy day. China's 1.3 billion population are more super savers than they are consumers. Average household saving rates in China are 25%. How many people in the room here today stashed away 25% of your income last year? I wish I had. The contribution of household consumption to GDP in China is low at around 35%. That compares to 70% in the US. At the Boao Forum in April, where the Australia-China Business Council led a delegation of our members, China's Premier, Wen Jiabao, said that confidence is more important than money or gold. As part of its stimulus policies, the Chinese government is spending more on social security in the hope of getting its people to save less and spend more. And as Kevin said and told us earlier, this policy is beginning to work and confidence is strong. But GDP growth is not the primary goal in China. Commerce Minister Chen Deming recently said his major concern and a major challenge for China is unemployment. And the crucial issue for China now is, will it be able to rebalance its own economy away from an export-driven economy to an investment and consumption-driven model of growth? Of course, China's rebound, or the reignition of Chinese dragon, will be good for Australia, and in particular, it will be good for Western Australia. China is by far our largest export market, accounting for over a quarter of our exports. Total exports to China last year were $22 billion, up a whopping 50% from 2007. And we are certainly fortunate here in Western Australia that we have the Chinese market to provide a base level of demand for our commodities that really provides a floor in our economic outlook. Along with the massive increase in our trade with China has been a more recent surge in Chinese investments in the resources sector. In the last 2 years, we've seen some large transactions like those listed here. If completed, MinMetals' transaction with Oz Minerals will have a value of $1.2 billion. But even with further investments, China's total investments in Australia are still very small compared to our traditional investment partners such as the US, the UK and Japan. The reality is that further Chinese investment is essential to Australia's national interests to add ballast to our trade relationship. And of course, Chinese investment means Australian jobs. And that is incredibly important, particularly in an environment where an increasing number of Australians are losing their jobs. So let me repeat that. Chinese investment equals Australian jobs. And for the larger projects, such as CITIC Pacific's $5.2 billion Sino-Iron project, which adds processing capacity, a pellet plant, power station and a desalination plant, the jobs created go way beyond the 4,000 construction jobs, but create significant levels of employment in the regions in ongoing operations for the next 25 years. Now, I'm sure one question on your lips, or the elephant in the room, is what does the collapse of the US $19.5 billion deal between Rio and Chinalco mean for Australia? From one perspective, the collapse of the deal may be in Australia's national interest. Should checks from Beijing fund new projects in Australia rather than flowing to buy out interests of London-based Rio shareholders? I suspect that last Friday, Andrew Forrest and Gina Reinhart each danced the jig. Probably separately. Chinese investment may be encouraged now in alternate supply chains and mining operations not owned by Rio and BHP, such as FMG, Australasian Resources, Brockman Resources, BCI, and many others. Now, of course, there remains the threat of alternate Chinese investments into projects in southern Africa and Brazil, should Chinese disenchantment with Australia arise too high. But we hope not, as Australia has been a good partner for China. We have, over the past 4 or 5 years, progressively discounted our ore prices against our competitors, and our ore has, in fact, effectively become cheaper relative to other countries and suppliers. Also, We have given China opportunities where other developed nations have not. We have the first Chinese EPC, as I mentioned, in the Sino-Iron project in the developed world, and many sets of industrial equipment manufactured in China have taken hold first in the Australian marketplace. However, China may feel that the delays in Australian government FIRB approval process have contributed in a small way to this outcome. Now, personally, I think the time frame taken by the FIRB to consider the complex Chinalco-Rio transaction was appropriate. But some of the FIRB delays, such as the six-month assessment period for the vanilla investment from AmSteel into Jindalby, appear difficult to understand. Of course, another way to look at the collapse of the transaction and the proposed production joint venture between Rio and BHP is to consider how much lower the big two will move down the cost curve as a result of the significant cost benefits that are expected to be realized over time. There is the potential that should just some of these savings be passed on to customers and not all to shareholders, that other new projects, including the higher value-adding magnetite projects, may be squeezed out purely on cost competitiveness grounds, regardless of any strategic desire that China may have to diversify its sources of supply. The magnetite projects may instead need to focus on replacing expensive Chinese domestic iron ore production. I'd just like to finish with some brief comments about the US-China relationship, which, as Richard mentioned, is very important. It's probably no more important relationship for us anywhere in the world than the relationship between the US and China. We have heard recent calls from China's leaders for the US dollar to be replaced as the world's reserve currency. With the US printing more and more dollars, China is increasingly worried about the impact that any resulting US dollar depreciation will have on the value of its massive US dollar foreign currency reserves. This desire to reduce exposure to the US dollar is an opportunity for us and is one of the major drivers behind the current spate of Chinese investment into resources in Australia and globally. While China may want to replace the US dollar, any precipitous move to sell off the US dollar would harm China seriously and is therefore highly unlikely. The visit to China by US Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner last week was also very important, and it's significant that Mr. Geithner did not use the visit to criticize China about an undervalued yuan, and I think that represents a growing maturity in the relationship between the US and China. Indeed, the extent, the frequency, and the quality of the high-level dialogue between Beijing and Washington would, I think, surprise many Australians. Mr. Geithner also said that purchases by US consumers could not be as dominant a driver of growth in the future as they've been in the past, and that China needs to unlock the spending power of its own consumers. And I think this is a message which the Chinese government has heard and understands. So overall, in conclusion, I remain convinced that the long-term prize in China remains enticing, and not just for Australia, but for global economies. The super cycle of commodity demand from India and China, I believe, has paused, not halted. And China remains the key market for our commodities and the natural partner for us to develop our resources. And we, in turn, remain the most efficient, stable, cost-effective, and long-term secure source of supply for China for the key commodities they need. Thank you.